Welcome to Book to the Family by B.M. Palmer, J.W. Alexander. We are continuing to read at page 75 for this reading. Chapter 4, Authority of the Parent. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. Colossians 3:21. After the conjugal comes the parental relation, presenting the second couplet of reciprocal duties. The parent precedes the child, therefore his office is the first to be considered. And the interesting question meets us at the threshold. Why, in the passage at the head of this chapter, and also in the parallel passage in Ephesians 6:4, the injunction should be laid upon the father? Evidently, there is intended here no exclusion of the mother, for she is associated with him in a joint role. The answer is that it is addressed to him as the head of the household, the official representative of the government within the same. In the Decalogue, for example, where the law of the parental relation simply is laid down, the two are conjointly recognized in the words, honor thy father and thy mother. But here the apostle is tracing the different parts of the family constitution with special reference to the subordination which subsists between them. The injunction is, therefore, carried up to the functionary in whom the authority is primarily lodged. Bearing in mind that the apostle is stringing together all the relations of the family upon the one principle around which they crystallize, the omission of the mother in these counsels, evidently designed for parental guidance, is eminently suggestive. With the terseness and brevity so characteristic of the Bible, the generic title of the relation is here pretermitted, lest the subordination of office in the domestic state should be overcast and clouded. In the very form of the language, the responsibility is laid squarely at the source and fountain of the power. But, of course, it descends by necessary inference to her whose authority is derived by association with him in whom it is original and supreme. And in the act of assuming it, she is gently reminded of the submission which marks her position and through which her own authority has been acquired. Her control, however, is nonetheless real because it is here conveyed only by implication, or because it is a control which descends to her from a source which is higher. Let not the reader dismiss this as a mere refinement of thought. Undoubtedly, the father has a natural right to rule, because he begets. But so has the mother an equal right, grounded also in nature, because she produces. This would yield two wills, both of which are supreme, each resting upon a different basis and destined to clash through the modifications which attach to both. The scriptures, however, lift the whole subject to a higher plane and effect a perfect reconciliation between the two. They teach that the family is a divinely constituted state in which the parents rule, not simply by natural right, but by an authority immediately delegated from God. Hence, in the moral law, the fifth commandment forms the transition between the two tables and is the link by which they are connected. Will it not exalt our conceptions of the family to see how exactly God has placed it in the bosom of the law? As the root from which all human relations grow, it is the point where the exposition of all our relative duties must begin. And yet, this fifth commandment springs right out of the first table as naturally as a new arch rises from the buttress which supports it. We can hardly tell to which of the two tables it most belongs. Clearly to the second, because it defines a human relation and expounds an earthly duty. But as clearly to the first, because it states a duty that is primarily owed to God. The fact is, when God descends to dwell amongst men and covers with his law the whole sphere of human duty, he makes his appearance first in the family. He constitutes the husband his representative to the wife, and the father his representative to the child. The authority is lodged with the male as generically including the female from whom, by derivation, she was at the first created. In marriage, by its fundamental law, she is again integrated into the man, from whose substance she was taken by the voluntary coalescence of her own will. Through this free submission, she is one with him in the authority which comes derivatively to her, as his came from God by immediate delegation. Her natural right, which springs from the fact that she gives birth, is taken up into the right that is supremely bestowed from heaven. Subordination and unity of will are secured, and in this parental injunction, the mother is seated as a queen upon the throne, ruling under the king. We are brought now to the parental function, expressed, as in the other relations, by a single word, fathers, provoke not. The language is not only cautionary, but expository. The reference is clearly to the family as a school for training. Children are given to us not simply to be enjoyed and caressed, but to be educated for this life and for the life to come. The admonition is addressed to parents in a form that at once recognizes the disciplinary office with which they are charged and the peril of miscarriage. Power is a sacred trust, and its abuse is a constant temptation. Beneath the negative style of the admonition, we ought to discover a positive principle, made the more impressive from the labor of unearthing it. This positive statement we take to be that children should never be thrown into an attitude of antagonism to the parent. Were this guiding principle carried steadily through the parental administration, it would protect against a thousand errors and save many a household from the wreck which we are often compelled so sadly to witness. The term used by the apostle is, of course, a grant of power, and thus it guards against the other extreme of lawlessness and of misrule. But whilst the supremacy is fairly admitted, and its due exercise is, by necessary implication, taught, it is softened by the qualification which is imposed. The rule of the parent is one of law, but of law as tempered with grace. The father must recognize his responsibility to the whole nature of the child and regard him as a being to be molded as well as controlled. This is the key to the interpretation of the passage. Authority must be used not only to subdue, but to train. The obedience of the child is to be free and unconstrained under the promptings of affection. He must not be teased and worried and provoked until he loses heart and renders an obedience in which there is no soul, lest they be discouraged, adds the apostle. In the corresponding passage found in Ephesians 6:4, the educational office of the parent is more distinctly announced. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. We regard the expression, then, as defining the gracious character of the parent's authority to be used for edification and not for destruction. The splendid advantages for training possessed by the parent diminishes by just so much the necessity for bald external authority. Let these be considered a little by way of illustrating this position. For example, there is the long minority of the child, affording opportunity for a constant and equable pressure in shaping its character. Time is always an important element in human affairs, but nowhere so important as here. The dominion of the parent, it must be remembered, is strictly a moral one, over a will which must be expected to break forth from its own spontaneity in occasional resistance of all control. It is only by degrees the great lesson is acquired that this will must move in its appointed sphere, defined by proper meets and bounds. The ligature need not be severe, because there is ample time to secure the result more effectually by the interposition of gentle restraints. The object is not to break that will, but to educate it, not to bind its freedom by external force, but to teach it to control itself. It is enough to swathe it loosely until it shall learn how to check its own lawlessness. With this, a sweet moral influence should blend until obedience becomes its choice and it finds its highest freedom in moving upon the plane which law prescribes for its action. If the conflict be renewed 1,000 times, still the long minority which nature has provided gives room to patience to do its gentle but effective work in training what is wild and rendering it tractable to duty. He is an unwise parent who disregards this assistance of time and who seeks to carry the will of his child by assault rather than by siege. It should not be overlooked that other faculties exist besides that of will. There is reason to be developed, affections to be cultivated, conscience to be directed, taste and sensibility to be quickened. These all bring their aid in the discipline of the will, which may be manipulated with caresses as well as bruised with punishment. The silent and steady growth of all these powers together is what the parent is called to foster, and the length of the probation leaves him almost inexcusable who fails entirely. The case must, at least, be one of inveterate stubbornness which does not yield to the judicious and patient treatment of 20 years. This process is materially aided by the extreme dependence of childhood. The heart must be unfeeling which is not continually touched by this. Indeed, one of the special perils of the parent is that of swerving from his duty, from the tenderness of his sympathies. But what a lever does it put into his hands in the conflict with a child's will? Its helplessness is so complete, and the instinct of it is so strong, that the principle of subjection may be fairly established before a serious purpose of resistance can be formed. The fact is, the parent's trouble arises more from the natural impatience of the child than from any distinct notion of resistance to authority. This is to be expected from the autonomy of the child's nature, and is far from being in itself an evil omen. It is only when that will is unduly stubborn and takes on the air of open defiance that it becomes portentous. But a strong protection against this is the child's own sense of need, which causes it to cling to the parents' protection and care. If early advantage be taken of this instinct, the will may be brought into the habit of submission before the clear consciousness is had that such a faculty exists at all. At this stage, the authority may be as mild as love itself without impairing its efficiency. The crown is put upon this thought when we add to it the natural credulity and homage of childhood. The ignorance at first is so supreme that all knowledge must come to it from testimony. No sooner are the senses aroused to observation than they begin to collect the materials of knowledge, and the proverbial credulity of the child is simply a mental instinct which renders it capable of receiving information. It is a latter process when it understands to sift this testimony through the faculty of the reason, which is later in being developed. Combined with this, the natural reverence of childhood, which bows before the majesty of the parent with something akin to that worship with which we bow before our Maker. And what is to hinder that parent from erecting an altar in the heart of his child, upon which the sacrifice of a daily obedience will be cheerfully offered? The fact, too, that they are born at intervals, and at intervals sufficiently far removed to allow the full assertion of parental supremacy, is somewhat significant. The great practical error in family government lies in the almost universal overlooking of this idea, which, therefore, we express with none the less gravity because the reader will be likely to greet it with a smile. The grand fallacy consists in assuming that the child must know in order to obey, and therefore it must be waited on for the knowledge ere the obedience is exacted. It should obey without knowing. The will and the affections are in exercise before the judgment and the reason. These are to be met at the threshold. At the first dawn of intelligence, the child should find itself under authority and obey by the power of instinct. If the mastery is to be acquired after the will has developed itself in flagrant opposition to authority, the conflict must be proportionally severe and rarely ends in the parent's acknowledged triumph. We doubt if a child was ever thoroughly conquered after 2 years of age. Nature has wonderful modes of training if we are only wise enough to take her hint. The influence of older children upon the younger is an important element in family training. The household is a group, and the most wonderful feature in it is the complex influences which are constantly at work. There is always a firstborn, and it is a cruel satire to say that two grown-up persons cannot manage one poor little weakling whose only resource is to cry without forging the thunderbolts of Jove. Now, if parental authority be mildly but firmly established at the beginning, the contagion of example and the reflection of authority in the submission of the older will settle the law at once in the hearts of the younger. It is often alleged that domestic discipline waxes milder with the advancing age of the parent. It ought to be so in the nature of the case, for with experience comes tact, and the nice sense that avoids unnecessary issues with the child. But the large assistance derived from the trained obedience of older brothers and sisters will go far to explain the difference which is sometimes pointed at a trifle invidiously. We mention further only the immense advantage of constant supervision. It is the nearest to omnipresence of anything purely human. When is the eye of the parent ever withdrawn? How it watches when itself unseen? A watchfulness, too, so free from espionage or the scrutiny of a detective. A watchfulness so full of love and tender sympathy and providential care that the child greets it as a perpetual benediction, greets it as it greets the sunlight of heaven, shining unobtrusive because shining everywhere. This wonderful police in the family, we do not know with what to compare it, except with the surveillance of conscience in the individual breast, so omnipresent, so faithful, so benevolent, even in its reproaches. We signalize only the provision for this in the office of the mother, she, the gentle one, whom nature has made so loving to those born of her body. She, too, who has learned obedience for herself, she has the function of sitting in the midst of her nestlings, that she may be to them a holy providence. Sometimes with a smile, sometimes with a frown, always watching, soothing, stroking, shaping with her tender hands the hearts which are, by and by, to be so strong for duty. We see then the import of the Apostle's words, "Provoke not." That authority is not all a parent has to wield, but influence as well. that when the scepter of rule is stretched over the domestic state, there may be a cunning which shall wreathe it with roses and conceal its harshness. It remains then only to suggest some of the obvious forms under which this provocation may lurk. 1. When there is habitual sternness holding the child at bay and never entering into living sympathy with its joys and sorrows. Sometimes this arises from natural temperament. The parent is constitutionally phlegmatic and cold and finds nothing more difficult than to break through the reserve which hangs like a veil over his heart. Sometimes it arises from the preoccupations of business, which absorbs the attention and draws one off from communion with those about him in life. Sometimes, alas, it springs from a misdirected conscientiousness which fears to indulge in pleasantry, lest the reins of austerity should escape from the grasp. The more is the pity when religious principle puts on this authority and repels where it should draw. It cannot be doubted that many parents, who in all other respects are models of faithfulness, make their piety hateful by clothing it in this ascetic garb. It is a sad loss all around, a loss to the parent who loses the cream of domestic joy in thus shutting out from his bosom the young prattler, who should make the sweetness of love spring like honey out of the rock itself, and a deeper, sadder loss to the child, who is every day cheated of its birthright. It is the climax of parental tact when the faculty is possessed of letting oneself down into the very heart of childhood in fresh and genial sympathy with all it finds there. Such a parent governs easily and well, and governs almost without curb or rein. 2. The evil is aggravated when there is a constant and hard exaction of duty. Oh, those shadows which fall upon childhood when the parental voice is never heard except to issue a command. The case is worse if the commands and restrictions are capricious. But even when reasonable and just, surely the parent is something more than an overseer. The quick sensibility of a child feels, even where it cannot explain, the wrench in its relations when it can never come into the father's presence without being ordered off upon some duty. It has an unreasoning instinct which tells it has sometimes the right to sit down in the light of that father's smile and rejoice in his love. 3. Greater yet is the discouragement when it is greeted with needless and captious criticism. The dissatisfaction may not always be groundless, nor the censure unmerited, but it is not wise to be on the alert to find fault. Due allowance must be made for the inconsiderateness of youth, and few things provoke resentment more than to be subjected constantly to rigid scrutiny as under an inspector's drill. It is better to allow the rent in the jacket sleeve than to make a worse rent in the boy's heart, who is repelled from a parent to whom he must give account for every mishap in a boy's rude play. Close akin to this spirit of criticism is the selfish withholding of commendation and praise where there is an evident desire to please. Even children who are not exact types of youthful piety after the pattern of much of our Sunday school literature have a great many moments of good humor when they wish to gratify those about them, and a little judicious praise is a healthy stimulant to virtue. We have known persons in all the walks of life to whom it would have proved a wholesome tonic, lifting up the flagging energies to new efforts of goodness in hours of despondency and gloom. Let the child's life be seasoned with a little approbation, and perhaps the path of virtue will not be altogether rugged to his feet. 4. It is a provocation to wrath when favoritism is indulged and disparaging comparisons are drawn. A child is a child, whatever its natural disposition may be, and it may honestly claim a child's place in the parents' affection. The jealousy which is aroused by an unjust partiality burns like a juniper coal in the heart that feels itself cast off, and the odious contrasts which are drawn are instinctively resented as insults added to wrong. The heart so treated will burn at length to a crisp under the fires of resentment. 5. Chastisement inflicted in anger or excessive in degree is certainly a just provocation to wrath. The impression of some that chastisement as such tends to break the spirit of a child is contradicted by universal experience. The youthful conscience may safely be trusted to recognize this necessary vindication of parental authority, but this conscience is equally quick to grade the severity of the infliction and to resent it as the mere expression of ill temper and spleen. Hence, too, the extreme injury of those modes of punishment which are designed conspicuously to humiliate and to degrade. The parent's office in this case is strictly judicial and must be exercised with transparent fairness and equity. It is not the temporary suffering that bruises the spirit of a child, but the sense of injustice rankling in the soul. It is doubtful if obedience ought ever to be enforced under a menace. It is thereby robbed of its frankness, and the probation is, to that extent, unfair. The child should be allowed the privilege of deferring to authority upon the ground of its rightfulness, and of substantiating his obedience as springing from principle. It is then seen to be honorable in its source, and the youthful character is ennobled. Punishment should never be administered in anger, for the simple reason that the principle upon which it turns is withdrawn alike from the view of parent and child. It attests simply the power of the one, and fulfills no office of discipline to the other. There is a clear distinction which no one is quicker than a child to perceive between a cool judicial displeasure and the passion which wreaks its vengeance upon the helpless. 6. Last of all, among these parental provocations, is the unwise retention of authority when it should gradually give way to persuasion. A long season of training is allowed the parent, from infancy to maturity. As the reason expands, and the affections unfold, and the conscience asserts its supremacy, the force of bare authority must slacken. It is a part of the training itself to throw the eaglets upon their own wing to balance in the air. The youth of 16 cannot be ruled as the boy of 6 years, and the parent has missed his chance who is not able, quietly and by degrees, to substitute influence in the place of authority. Of course, wisdom and tact are required in effecting the change, but as the time must come when the exercise of authority shall cease, the manner of its gentle abdication should be the parent's study. And they who seek to perpetuate it in its original cast-iron form will succeed only in provoking their children to wrath. Chapter 5, Filial Obedience. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Colossians 3:20. The filial relation is correlative with the parental and comes up next for consideration. It will be observed that the generic title, parent, is here employed. The reason is obvious. The obligation of the child is to both, and it is not required to note any distinction as to their authority. The proper place to mark this is where the authority is conferred, and, as we have already seen, the principle of subordination was secured in the preeminence assigned to the father and in the derivation of the power from him to the mother. As to the child, the authority is conjoint and must be recognized as one. It is easy to see that discord would be introduced into the administration if the subjects under it were allowed to discriminate between the two. There is now no difference in the complexion of the authority, for the two are blended in the administration. A happy illustration is afforded of the nicety and precision of the language of the Bible, that in all the passages which expound the duties of the child, no distinction is hinted at between the parents, whilst in the instruction given to the parents themselves, they carefully intimate the supremacy of him who is constituted the head of the household. Thus, in the parallel injunction found in Ephesians 6:1-2, it reads, "Children, obey your parents. Honor thy father and mother." The latter clause being itself a quotation from the fifth commandment in the Decalogue. We specify this feature all the more as it confirms the general interpretation we have given of the domestic code, the principle running through which is the articulation of all the parts into one body, and the consequent subordination between them. Filial duties are embraced in the single word obedience, which we shall discover to be entirely appropriate as defining the nature of the relation here, the relation in itself. We encounter here again the problem of coordinated wills, as in our primary relation to God. His will must be supreme, and our will must bow before it in free subserviency to his control over the creature in all things. As in the conjugal tie, the wife must blend her whole being with that of her head in the voluntary submission of her will to his. So again must the child's will, moving freely upon its own plane, bend before the majesty of the parental. Thus, so far as we have yet traced it, the supremacy of law is upheld from the throne of Jehovah itself downward through all the concentric circles of human relationship and of human duty. Will is drawn up and is enfolded within will. Order is maintained throughout by this subordination of the lower to the higher, whilst individual freedom remains to each in the spontaneity with which the obeisance is rendered. In every case, will turns by its own polarity upon its own pivot and over the entire sphere in which it is appointed. Sphere. Whilst it is magnetized by the influence that is above it, and obeys the secret power that points it ever upward to the sphere in which it is taken up. This subordination is, in each case, expressed by a different word. The wife submits, the child obeys. The selection is far from being accidental. Both suggest a subjection of will. But along with this, the peculiar property by which the two are discriminated. It may be worthwhile to trace this distinction a little further than we have heretofore done. In the conjugal relation, there is absolute union between the parties. In the parental, there is simply connection. The woman, by the law of marriage, is reintegrated into the man from whose side she was originally drawn. She never exists afterward an independent person. By her voluntary act, she is merged civilly and legally into the man. With her office in the household perfectly defined, her status in the same is determined by her relation to the husband. All her privileges and rights flow to her from this association with her head. There is demanded of her, therefore, a blending of the will, which shall, so to speak, make the two organically one. There must be, on her part, a cleaving to him, which shall, in some sort, mingle together their distinct personalities. What term shall express this peculiar coalescence of her will with his? The scriptures have chosen the word submit to enunciate its exact character, a blending of the will, not in one or in a thousand of its separate determinations, but in its innermost essence and being. Her will unites with his, not in this and that particular act, but antecedently to all acts. It blends as naked will itself with the will which is its counterpart and fellow. The word submission covers this shade of idea, the union of nature, the mixture of being, the blending of personality. In the filial relation, however, the connection with the parent is conceivably close, but it is not union. In the ideal conception of it, the child is separate from the parent, and the distance widens betwixt them until, at maturity, the child swings off upon a path of entire independence. Whilst, therefore, the unity of the household must be preserved by a due subordination of will, it is not subordination mounting into actual coalescence. This shade of thought is marked in the word chosen by inspiration to express it, for obedience looks to the acts of the will rather than to its substance or essence. It recognizes the remoteness of the relation which the child sustains and signalizes the separateness and independence of its will, which can only be subordinated to that of the parent in the way of external homage. Obedience is not the will consciously blending itself with another will in organic union, but it is will conscious of its separateness, bringing its own acts and laying them a sacrifice upon the altar of duty. This little essay proposes only to sketch the outline of the family constitution, and particularly to denote the central principle of subordination by which all its different relations are adjusted. It would only obscure this design to dwell minutely upon the various duties which are involved. Filial obedience will, therefore, be discussed only as to its nature and the ground upon which it rests. We shall thus have a clearer view of the family as the sphere in which successive generations of men are brought under subjection to law and are thereby fitted to be useful and happy, both here and hereafter. 1. Authority is here presented to the conscience as grounded in absolute right. Children, says Paul, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. A broad foundation is thus laid upon which a steady obedience may rest, for the appeal is made to the intelligence and reason, as well as to the conscience and heart of the child. At first it may be instinctive or rendered from a sense of helplessness, but as character is formed, the obedience draws deeper and lays other faculties under requisition. It must express the whole moral nature just so soon as its attributes come to be developed, and in exact proportion to that development. If the individual will is prone to assert itself, then conscience and judgment fly to the rescue and plead for the authority as essentially righteous. No right can be imagined more perfect. It is not an acquired, but a natural right. It is not founded upon purchase or conquest, but upon natural relationship. There is nothing about it accidental or provisional. Its character is absolute. Hearken to thy father that begat thee, says Solomon, and she that bare thee shall rejoice. The injunction penetrates to the very foundations of our being. It lays the right supremely in this, that the parent is instrumentally the child's creator. The scriptures abundantly recognize this representative relationship. The whole human race existed potentially in the loins of Adam, and were dealt with in him. All Israel were in the loins of Abraham, and so became heirs of the promise. And the child is viewed in the loins of its father before it sees the light. It is born by the mother within the walls of her flesh, and the earliest pulses of the infant heart beat with the power of her life, which it so mysteriously shares, destined at length to an existence which shall be apart from both. The connection is maintained through a period of dependence, during which it still exists civilly and legally in them. With this derivation from the parent flows the parent's natural right to rule. In all these original relations, nature has planted the instincts which are necessary to maintain them. In the parent is found what we may concisely term the providential instinct, as strong in man as in the bird that flutters over its brood. In the child exists the instinct of dependence, which cleaves to the protection and care indispensable to its preservation. From the dawn of its reason, the child is accustomed to view its state of subordination as in accordance with nature, and its simple instincts recognize the subjection as fitting and just. The harshness of authority is thus completely removed. The child can have no sense of humiliation in the dependence which is natural to it, and no feeling of degradation in the obedience which this necessitates. All is rendered easy by the instinct of nature in the beginning, and afterward reason and conscience confirm it as right. In truth, the child needs this authority as a support to its own will when learning how to exercise itself, just as the young eagles fear to trust their own wing at first and are borne up by the parent bird while practicing it upon the air. In this, as in everything else, the dependent child comes back to the strength and protection whose support it constantly requires, whilst the sweet affections which are engendered in the act of communicating and receiving make the dependence itself easy and agreeable. But the parent's right is not only natural, it is supernatural. It is a right immediately conferred by God. This is implied in the original grant of power to them and in the limitations which grace imposes in its exercise. It is more distinctly recognized in the injunctions laid upon the child, "Obey your parents in the Lord." And again, "Obey your parents, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord." The religious element of our nature finds perhaps its earliest action here. The child must obey for conscience' sake, or rise in rebellion against the control which is supreme. Parental authority being a shadow of the divine, obedience to it becomes the first act of worship to the Creator. This principle, of course, cannot be expected to operate until the moral nature begins to develop. But as soon as the distinction betwixt right and wrong can be perceived at all, it is recognized just here. And perhaps the very earliest discrimination of the child between the two is made in the light of the parent's commands. When the conscience is so far educated as to recognize the divine sanction fully, the last vestige of shame is taken away from the obedience rendered. It can be no mortification to the creature to bow before the will of the infinite Creator, who appoints the parent as his receiver, to gather up the obedience and the worship which are supremely due to him. 2. Parental authority is universal in its sweep. Obey your parents in all things is the command. The question, of course, arises whether this is to be construed as strictly literal. With human nature corrupt as it is, may not these parental commands be sometimes immoral? In that case, is not the child shut up between two classes of obligation, both of which appear equally imperative, since both rest upon the same divine authority? A limitation must exist somewhere, but it must be sought in the law given to the parent, not in the law given to the child. In the first place, all parental authority is delegated, to which, from the nature of the case, a corresponding responsibility attaches. If the parent rules as the representative of God, he must rule according to the will of God. It would be preposterous to plead the divine sanction in commanding what is in itself sinful. He clearly transcends the bounds of his authority as soon as he clashes with the superior authority which is the source of his own. Even were there no restraining clause defining the extent of his prerogatives, still this qualification must be supposed. Ruling under a law, his authority is vacated whenever the attempt is made to exalt it above that of the being by whom it was originally conferred. He has been guilty of an act of treason against the supremacy of his King and Lord. In the next place, the office of the parent as an educator makes him doubly guilty for such an assault upon the moral nature of his ward. He is placed at the fountainhead of the child's being, that he may shape its earliest affections and thoughts. His empire over the will is a subsidiary to the higher end of developing and training the whole moral nature of his offspring. In the very grant of the jurisdiction, its object is distinctly stated, that he may bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. The moral law, which is the inflexible rule of human conduct, must be the text of all parental instructions. To issue commands which are contradictory to this is therefore not only a crime against God, but it is a crime against his child. He bruises and maims that nature which was put into his hands when most supple and plastic to be molded aright. He is guilty of such malfeasance in office as deprives him of all constitutional power in the premises. Still further, his authority in this direction is bridled by the explicit language of the lawgiver. It is found in the clauses upon which we have already commented. The father is enjoined not to provoke. What provocation can be more cruel and unjust than to force one to sin? He is commanded to bring up his child in the nurture of the Lord. The language to him is the same as that addressed by the daughter of Pharaoh to the mother of Moses. Take this child and nurse it for me. Not, however, to repeat what we have already said, here again is the restriction inserted in the admonition to children. Obey your parents in the Lord. Obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Evidently, in accepting authority, the parent is bound to look at the entire code in which the reciprocal obligations are stated. In this particular connection, the divine will is presented as a motive to filial obedience, but it reflects equally upon parental authority. If the child must obey in the Lord, the parent must command in the Lord. If the child must obey as well-pleasing to the Lord, the parent is equally to please the Lord in his rule. The two obligations are strictly correlative, and both come under the same direction and sanction. In no case can the parent plead a divine warrant for obedience in unlawful things. He must rule, and the child must obey, under the law which sets forth the supreme authority of him who is the creator and Lord of them both. This sweeping phrase, in all things, refers simply to the extent of proper parental authority, in regard to which the child is not vested with discretion to judge. It would defeat the end of all law were the subjects under it allowed to decide the question of jurisdiction. The protection against the abuse of power must be found in the guards thrown around the power itself, as we have seen in the charter which vests the parent with all his prerogatives. If his will should, however, deliberately set aside the law of God, which is supreme, and if the child's conscience be sufficiently educated to perceive the issue that is joined, why then the case is analogous to what sometimes happens with people or nation, which is driven by oppression to overturn the despotism. Falling back upon rights which antecedently exist by the gift of God, and which no human government can lawfully contravene. In such a collision, the law of obedience to the child is to obey only in the Lord, and the responsibility remains with the parent who has perpetrated the outrage. The resistance in this case seems to us to be grounded upon the same principle with the right of revolution, which is recognized by the law of nature and of nations as alienable and indestructible. But in setting up a constitutional government for the family, the broad principle of subordination must be laid down without weakening its force by considering the exceptional cases of abuse which are elsewhere provided against. In the exercise of authority, which is directly contrary to this Constitution, the appeal must be taken to him who ordained it, that he may restrain or avenge what is treasonable to himself. 3. The obedience of childhood is strictly probationary. It is at first absolute in its character, a mere binding of the will to that which is superior to it. But with opening intelligence, it becomes more and more voluntary, not so much constrained by the pressure of its own feebleness as it is prompted by affection and regulated by conscience. With the greater measure of self-control which is gradually acquired, the force of authority diminishes until, at mature years, it entirely ceases. The law of obedience is, indeed, at no period of life exactly canceled, but it takes the form at length of deferential and worshipful homage of the parent, who is increasingly venerable with age. All these stages, thus briefly sketched, indicate the purpose for which this obedience is enjoined. The great achievement in life is to become the complete masters of ourselves. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his own spirit than he that taketh a city. No one is prepared to assume the trusts of life until the will, which is the executive faculty, is brought under subjection to the reason. Hence the unconditional submission required at the period when the will has to be broken in, and when the instinct of helplessness claims the protection of authority. The two are adjusted to each other with almost mechanical precision. The language of parental discipline is, take up that will and hold it in hand. The trial may, perhaps, be severe, as the stubborn conflict with authority sometimes evinces, but as self-mastery is gained through the habit of subordination, the rein is thrown more loosely upon the neck until it ceases to be drawn at all. Thus the family is the school in which men are trained for the duties of citizenship, for the strongest government would be shattered in a day were not the concurrent wills of which it is composed taught how to blend with mutual concessions. The limited duration and the probationary character of filial obedience exemplify the principles on which it is based and reveal the beneficent design of the whole dispensation. So far from degrading in its tendency, its whole aim is to ennoble, to fit the young for the responsibilities and duties which will devolve upon them in after years. The probation of childhood extends beyond this, and its obedience enters as an element into the formation of religious character. A constant deference must be paid to the wisdom which is higher than its own. There may be questioning enough, but it is without disputation. The parent is the child's oracle, whose decisions are accepted as nearly infallible. Who does not see the influence of this in shaping the religious character? In this sphere, where all rests upon testimony, and in which faith is the fundamental law, a wisdom which is supreme must be accepted as the only guide. The family fulfills a high function when it disciplines the young spirit, just as it opens its wandering eyes upon all the mysteries of nature and of God, to receive by simple faith what its own ignorance can neither anticipate nor deny. But this thought will reappear in another connection, to which it more logically belongs. 4. God has lent a gracious sanction to filial obedience in the promise appended to it. It is not the province of law to hold out rewards, except so far as these may be implied in the threat which is its sanction. Law speaks rather with the voice of authority. Its office is not to persuade, but to enjoin. It exhorts no further than in the appeal which it makes to the self-interest of men. But here, in the center of the moral law, is a commandment with promise. In the New Testament, it is re-engrossed and stamped with the seal of grace, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. As though to add a deeper emphasis, this obedience is declared to be well-pleasing unto the Lord. One is tempted to speculate upon the reasons for this discrimination. But whatever these may be, it invests the parent's office with equal solemnity and sweetness. With solemnity because God takes it so immediately under his guardianship. With sweetness, because his smile beams with such open approval of the obedience which is rendered. The homage to the parent, as his representative in the household, is as the incense of worship offered at his altar. It is grateful to him that the principle of obedience should be early rooted in the soul. Which needs but the transforming touch of the Holy Spirit in the new birth to become the spring of practical holiness in the believer. And because he will be known as the God of our salvation, he throws in this element of grace to soften the discipline of childhood and sanctifies to spiritual uses the natural relations of the flesh. The promise itself is abundantly fulfilled in various directions. It may be discovered in that happiness which flows into the child's heart through submission and service itself. In the goodness of God, the child acquires the great secret of life in its first lesson, that virtue is bliss. A subdued will is the indispensable condition of child happiness. Its desires are so capricious and its moods are so changeable as to be sources of positive torture to it, unless they are constantly controlled by a power that is steadier than its own. In the home it learns that life's pleasure is to be found in the faithful performance of duty, and that self-conquest is indispensable to happiness. The solid character, moreover, which is formed under this discipline, almost ensures the success which is promised. The qualities which are thus matured are precisely those drawn upon in the prosecution of every earthly calling, and which will wrest even from the hard fortune itself a final triumph over all obstacles. Whilst, in addition, the language of the promise conveys an assurance of the divine blessing. Large observation will astonishingly confirm the testimony that a dutiful child seldom fails to receive an earthly reward in the prosperity which a faithful providence manages to bestow, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. It is thus easy to see why obedience should define the filial relation, and the authority of the parent should lay the foundation of subjection to law in this world and in the next.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. You are welcome to make copies and give them to those in need. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. It is likely that the sermon or book that you just listened to is also available on cassette or video, or as a printed book or booklet. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."